Local News, Culture, and NPR.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me this evening. Coming up, Black Americans are underrepresented in American agriculture, making up just 1% of the 1% of Americans who farm. Coming up in the second half of the program, we meet a Black farmer in the Hudson Valley who serves primarily Black and Brown communities. Miguel Santiago talks to Kat Lopez of Sovereign Herbs. And we get the latest news from the River Reporter, including updates on key stories that we are following in our area, including the ongoing prison strike and the high NYSEG bills. Before we get to any of that, we have news in our region related to what's happening in Washington, D.C. The House narrowly passed a multi-trillion dollar budget framework yesterday, bringing President Trump's financial and legislative agenda one step closer to fruition. WAMC Hudson Valley Bureau Chief Jesse King reports on where the region's lawmakers stand.
The blueprint passed 217 to 215, despite disputes within the Republican majority and widespread opposition from Democrats. President Trump wants Congress to pass a, quote, big, beautiful bill that would extend tax breaks set in his first term and slash funding for federal programs. Tuesday's budget resolution calls for just that, with roughly $4.5 trillion in tax breaks and $2 trillion in cuts to long-term spending. What would be cut remains to be seen, but Democrats worry the budget resolution will pave the way for cuts to Medicaid, Social Security, SNAP benefits, and other social services. Democratic Congressman George Latimer of New York's 16th District spoke outside the Capitol before the vote.
The mission behind it is to open up enough financial wherewithal to give further tax cuts to the wealthiest people and the most successful corporations. That can't possibly be why we exist in this country. We want a strong America because we want the middle and the poor classes of this country to share in American success. Those who have been successful have to pay their share, their fair share.
As of October, more than 72 million Americans are enrolled in Medicaid. In a statement on X, Congressman Josh Riley says more than 240,000 people in the 19th district alone rely on it for their health care. The Democrat voted no. Congressman Pat Ryan also voted no. In a statement, the Democrat from the 18th district says the budget resolution also doesn't expand tax credits dating back to the American Rescue Plan that lowered insurance premiums for people with Medicaid and Medicare. Ryan says, quote, if Congress fails to renew the credits, premiums will go up for around 20 million Americans and 4 million Americans will lose coverage altogether, end quote. Congressman Mike Lawler, a Republican from the 17th district, voted for the resolution. He says the concerns over potential cuts to Medicaid are a lie and that a final budget hasn't been decided yet. In a statement on X, Lawler said he voted for the resolution because it would lift the cap on state and local tax deductions and shrink the size of the federal government.
I will always stand up against efforts to cut vital programs or take away your benefits. But it's very clear, with $36 trillion in debt and a $7 trillion budget, we have to rein in the size and scope of government. And we will root out waste, fraud, and abuse wherever it exists within every agency and department.
Ultimately, just one Republican, Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massey, voted against the resolution. Democrats unanimously opposed it, with just one representative, Arizona Democrat Raul Grijalva, not voting. The passage now allows Republicans to use a legislative process called reconciliation that could help them avoid a filibuster from Democrats in the Senate. Before Tuesday's vote, Congressman Paul Tonko, a Democrat from the 20th District, said he's spoken with countless constituents in Albany who oppose the resolution.
My constituents should never have to stand up and tell me they will interrupt their lives to fight with me in D.C. against the Republican agenda. But they did. Our job is to serve the American people, not rip access to basic necessities away from them at the behest of a president who declared himself king.
In Poughkeepsie, I'm Jesse King for the New York Public News Network.
Thank you to the New York Public News Network. Now on to other local news, and for that I turn to Ruby Rayner, the River Reporter. I actually spoke to Ruby earlier today, and we started by getting an update on the story of the ongoing prison strikes that are happening across New York State. But of course, also right here, we got an update on where things stand with those striking at Woodburn Correctional in our listening area.
Woodburn Correctional is in line with these New York State prisons, saying that they really are looking to have halts to be repealed, as well as for staffing issues to be recognized. But specifically for Woodburn, which is a little bit dissimilar and unique than perhaps all of the other strikes across the state in prisons, is that Woodburn ultimately decided to join the other prisons on strike because of these recent unknown chemical exposures to staff that have gone unexplained by the state. So there's been some reports of prisons potentially experiencing this, particularly at Woodburn. There's been two strings of these kind of identified symptoms related to staff members at Woodburn needing to be hospitalized. And the staff members suspect that it's due to exposure to chemicals. And the answer that they're getting from, you know, kind of the state is a whole lot of kind of nothing. And Cornish and Hoxie say that that really is the reason that Woodburn decided that they would join these strikes. There was about 8 different staff members from Woodburn last Monday night who were admitted to Garnet Health Harris with, you know, convulsions, dizziness, and these symptoms associated with the suspected chemical exposure. And what they received back from the state was that it was because of fatigue. And so these retired officers say that's really what drove Woodburn in particular staff to go on strike.
Right. And I'll remind the listener, too, here that we're covering this story on Monday. Our whole episode Monday evening was all about this issue of these prison strikes from multiple angles. And it's up at WJFFradio.org if you want to check it out. But we also feature an interview that Patricio did with Atik Weston, who's incarcerated, serving 15 years for manslaughter at Woodburn Correctional Facility. And what Atik told Patricio was that once the National Guard folks came in, things were actually better than they had been before the strike started. That's Atik's opinion. That was what he related to us from the inside. So thanks for that update on this big story. We're going to keep following the story because it's one of the biggest in our area right now. Another one really impacting.
Just a note.
Yeah.
One other thing about that is that I heard a recorded call between an inmate and their family member on after the National Guard was there. And there's one differentiation is that there's two sides. He was explaining this inmate to the prison. And so there was different varying treatment based on the way the cells were configured. And from the National Guard and the staff there. So that could be one contributing factor as to why, you know, different inmates had different experiences with what the National Guard was doing once they got there.
Okay. Another story that we're following and impacting our area, especially right here in Liberty, is the PepsiCo closure of their facility in Liberty, a manufacturing facility. You've got some more details on this story as well.
Yeah, definitely. So I know you've talked about how the announcement of the Frito-Lay PepsiCo plant in Liberty is closing, laying off its 287 employees after 2 decades of kind of being open. There was some comments on social media about the closure and questions around whether the closure had anything to do with contracts or agreements with the IDA, the Sullivan County IDA, who promotes economic development in the area and oftentimes gives economic incentives like tax breaks and help with development and stuff like that. And so I, you know, kind of took a look at what the Frito-Lay's agreement and if there was any ongoing projects with the IDA. And just so that listeners know, it worked with Ideal Snack Corp, which eventually then became Frito-Lay starting in 2002. But in 2023, Frito-Lay ended all agreements with the IDA, according to the project paperwork on the IDA's website. So they were receiving economic incentives and benefits up until 2023. So it's been some time since Frito-Lay has been in any agreement with the IDA.
Okay, and then another story that we are still covering is also the people getting these high bills from NYSEG. You spoke to the NYSEG earlier this week, and I know there's going to be another public meeting that we're going to be covering that's coming up. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so just to refresh listeners, a lot of Sullivan County residents have been talking about rises in their NYSEG bills. I spoke to one prospective resident, Efrain Martinez, who said that he was charged nearly $550, and he usually pays a little more than $100 every month. And so he was concerned, along with lots of other people who have been writing in a Facebook group called My NYSEG Bill Double. The petition has come out of that Facebook group calling for Governor Kathy Hochul to investigate the price hikes. So I spoke with the NYSEG Director of Communications, Shelby Cohen. What she was saying is that NYSEG itself is in charge of determining the delivery rate. So they deliver the electric and the gas. But the actual cost of electric and gas is the provider, which is not them. So they give you the bill, and so, yes, your bill might be higher, but it's not because NYSEG themselves has increased their delivery rate, which is the only thing that they determine. Some other people have also noted that there's fees that they see on the bottom, and that's something that I wanted to go look at. I haven't seen an exact bill with that, but it's definitely something that people are feeling brunt of, and because of that, as you mentioned, there's going to be tomorrow at the Sullivan County Government Center, organized by Assemblywoman Paula Kay and State Senator Peter Oberacker, a workshop for folks who are concerned about their NYSEG bill, and they're going to be able to speak directly with NYSEG representatives and kind of ask them questions. So that will take place tomorrow, Thursday, February 27th at the Government Center.
And we're going to be covering that. Patricio is going to be there to report on that. And Patricio has also been talking to other customers. All right. Well, more to come on this story, too. As we said, Ruby, we are just about out of time. If we could just talk real quick about a story that we actually broke a couple times this week, a couple different ways, that the removal of the Skinners Falls Bridge is imminent but has been postponed. What's the latest?
Yeah, so the removal of the Skinners Falls Bridge was set to begin today, February 26th, with just preliminary work that was like preparing basically for further tests, so making sure that the roads were clear, that they were going to lay down kind of different flagging materials and get everything prepared. But even that has been delayed. PennDOT announced that they will not be beginning that today due to weather conditions, and so that work will not proceed until mid-March. And so that's the latest on the Skinners Falls Bridge.
All right. Well, and that's the latest from the River Reporter. These stories are up now at riverreporter.com. I've been talking to Ruby Rayner. Ruby, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It's a local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Well, farmers only make up about 1% of the American workforce. That's a very small percentage of the American workforce are farmers, and even smaller percentage of those farmers are black. Only about 1% of all farmers are black. So that's black folks being underrepresented in that field of farming. Kat Lopez is black, a farmer, and the owner of Sovereign Herbs, a small-scale farm in the Hudson Valley. And as part of its mission, Sovereign Herbs primarily serves black and brown communities in and around the area, fostering mutual aid and solidarity economies within Kingston, New York, through its pay it forward and donation models. Radio Catskills' Miguel Santiago spoke to Kat Lopez about how people can support black farmers, how she got into farming, and what she does at Sovereign Herbs.
Yeah, what I do there is everything. I get some help from volunteers and from community, but We currently go to like the Kingston Farmers Market. And then we also distribute food to a couple of other like food access organizations. So Columbia County Sanctuary up in Hudson, the Multicultural Bridge, which is in Lee, Massachusetts. And then we might be taking on another partnership in Kingston this year. I'm not going to name that yet. And then we also do Duchess Outreach, which is in Poughkeepsie. And we, yeah, donate at the Broadway Bubble. So.
And could you describe to me just the day-to-day of what you do, in these farm-related projects?
Yeah, sure. So the winter is a little bit slower. So I'm doing more of the back end, like administrative emails, grant writing. Right now we're also like building a greenhouse, which is wild to do that in like 20 degree weather, but you get a little bit used to it. Yeah, and the day to day is kind of just, you know, earlier on in the season, you're planning like what you're going to put in the ground. So I'm just coming up with like spreadsheets of different herbs, culturally relevant herbs for the Latino community. And yeah, we get to work. We start opening up the ground, we add compost. We're going to be putting down some landscape fabric, putting up fencing and irrigation. And then once things start growing, so maybe like later in May, early June, we'll start harvesting and distributing to those partners.
You mentioned something pretty interesting. You mentioned grant writing is one of the things that you have to do, which is something I really didn't consider someone who works in farming has to do. Could you speak to me a little bit more about that? It's so interesting.
Yeah, that's something that I just kind of started learning how to do because, yeah, as we know, farming isn't super lucrative, but you want to make sure that it's like, you know, financially stable. So, yeah, that's something I've been working on. So, yeah, just, you know, if I have time and if it makes sense and it aligns with what I'm doing, I just try and go for that as like a way to continue to support this this business.
If you don't mind me asking, do you think this aspect of grant writing, do you think it's something that you would recommend to people, or to people getting into farming?
Yeah, I think so. I would recommend it. It kind of just depends on like what your kind of niche is. Like if you feel like you just want to do like a very particular value-added good and you're like super focused on that and you feel like you have enough money coming in, then like there's like no need for it. But I think especially for like beginning farmers, it's a really helpful resource to have. So yeah, write the grants, especially if you're BIPOC and you know, you don't have like the same kind of access to land or infrastructure that maybe somebody who had that passed down has.
What about you? Like, what do you think is the most enjoyable thing about farming? Do you have anything that surprised you when you started working on it?
Surprised me. I guess for me, it's like just the connection and like being able to ground, like physically ground with the soil. Yeah, I think I have like some neurodivergent things and like anxiety and stuff. So it definitely helps to like be present with your body. So I think once I was working in this area, once I started, I was like, oh, wow, my body doesn't have to feel like it's at an 11 all the time. Like we can come down here and sort of level out.
There's a lot that needs to be said about how the topic of race intersects with nutrition and access to it. What do you think is the best approach for Black people to learn about nutrition and interact with it through farming?
Yeah, so a little bit about my background is I grew up in Hudson County in New Jersey, and it's like right across the river from, you know, Central Park from New York City. And I grew up in a single parent household till I was like about 8 or 9. And, you know, we were low income, you know, food stamps, things like that. So, yeah, to me, it's just really important to sort of like connect with this kind of food. I was vegetarian for a while in high school, and I just didn't have that many opportunities. Like growing up, we didn't really have like, you know, like a big yard to grow food in or anything like that. So I think, yeah, again, just getting your hands in the soil is really helpful. But I think it's also really important to find community that like also looks like you. I don't think it's like always the most important thing, but I think it's really helpful. At least it's been helpful in my experiences. Finding people who have like similar cuisine as you, you know, like, do we want to grow like epazote, or we have like the cilantro, or what, you know, whatever it is, hibiscus. I think it also like ignites like a spark in people when, like, I love seeing people like when I go to the bubble to drop off food and they're like, oh my God, I haven't had this like papalo in, I don't know, since I left my, you know, my country or whatever. So it's, I think that's a really important piece, is just like being in community with each other. And yeah, there's a lot of opportunities. So I think people just kind of got to crack out of their like shell a little bit and be like, hey, I don't have to like farm 12 hours a day, but I can go do like an hour and be a little bit closer to these people and these plants.
Now, you got me interested. Do you have, or do you know, like a specific food that you, that people normally bond over with when, you know, from the work that you've done?
I feel like for each community, it's a little bit different, but I guess I'll say some of the things that I've gotten strong reactions from are like, yeah, people always love cilantro, no matter who you are. But then there's some like, epazote, papalo, huacate, like things like that. Even, cebollin, which is just like chives kind of, or like scallions, things like that, that people don't see at the grocery store, you know? So it's like holds a special place in my heart, and they're so unique and delicious too that, you know, it's not surprising they get such a strong reaction.
I'm willing to bet there's a lot of difficulty in organizing projects. And I'm willing to bet, too, that teaching and learning about nutrition has its challenges, too. What do you think needs to change for young people, you know, the youth, to be more engaged in farming and to know what they're eating?
Yeah, I think there's some places that are starting to do it pretty well with the kids, like, you know, there's an organization up in Hudson called Kite's Nest, and those kids are really engaged. Like, I'm not exactly sure, but I think it's like an after school kind of program for the youth. So I think just programs like that are really important. Also, I think Rondout Valley School District also has like a buy-in program for farmers, so that the kids in school can also eat well. Because I know I did not have that kind of food growing up in school. It was like weird pizza and chocolate milk and just like, yeah, I wish I had been exposed to, you know, the herbs and the food that I'm growing now as a kid, because that would have been like such a radical shift in my life. But it's never too late, so.
Yeah, and now you got me wondering, what's something that you wish you knew about nutrition or about growing food or eating when you were a kid? Is there like something that you wish you'd known?
Yeah, and again, like being limited and being limited to certain food as youth, like, you know, it's just like pasta, tomato sauce, stuff like that. I wish that, yeah, I had someone like doing things that I'm doing, like my program or like similar programs around me, because I probably would have learned how to cook a lot sooner, which would have been nice. It's also like, yeah, just really important for your health, period. You know, whether it's for a kid or for an adult or grandparents, it's just really important to have like that healthy food, no spray, you know, no chemicals, that kind of stuff in your body. Yeah,
definitely. Cooking is a skill that it's, I don't want to say it's undervalued, but certainly I wish I would have known more about it earlier. Finally, how could we as consumers support Black farmers? What are different ways to do so?
Yeah, so I think for me in particular, you can just go to our Linktree, which is Sovereign Herbs LLC. And I'll say in general, I think a lot of Black farmers, I won't speak for everyone, but from what I've noticed, a lot of them just really are desiring more community, whether it's finding each other or people volunteering, people donating, people sharing resources, like if there's a grant out or if there's a farmer's market that's looking for new vendors. Yeah, I think all of that stuff is pretty helpful. And I think a lot of people are interested in how to build more mutual aid networks with each other, especially in this day and age. But yeah, and I'll say also outside of just Black farmers, I think it's important to just support your neighbors. You know, a lot of the reason why I do this work is because I saw such a shift in the last couple years of folks who were new to this area coming in and having a different income bracket and things like that. And so we do a pay it forward model at the Kingston Farmers Market. And I think it's, you know, just a little piece of what we can contribute towards, hey, remember you have neighbors here who were born and raised here, and it's your job to also help support them in whatever way you can, whether it's offering them a hand at, you know, the supermarket or at the laundromat, or, you know, referencing them to some Know Your Rights materials, things like that. So, yes, support the Black farmers. Yes, support the BIPOC farmers, and also support the BIPOC people in your area and build relationships with them, you know? I guess I'll share that I was called to this work around 2020, 2021 with the Black Lives Matter, uprisings and George Floyd. And, you know, my background was in a lot of market style farming. And I felt for a while before that, I had felt hey, this is not exactly what I want to be doing. So, yeah, I think it's just important to continue doing the things you love and finding your niche. You know, to me, it's really important to make sure that people like me with a similar background and reality as me are being fed. That is my work here. So yeah, I think it's just important work. And hopefully more people realize things like that are necessary for the community. Yeah.
Kat from Sovereign Herbs reminded us to just write our grants. Very important. Thank you so much for being here with us at Radio Catsco.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Liberty, I'm Miguel Santiago Colón for Radio Catsco.
Thanks so much for that story, Miguel. That's going to do it for the Local Edition. I've been your host tonight, Jason Dole. I will be back tomorrow night. We'll do it again. We'll talk to Philip Pantuso of the Times Union and get the news from him. But for now, you want to stay right where you are, because we've got more news coming up next. And then at 7, we've got the Retro Cocktail Hour, and then 2 more hours of great music from Upfront Soul after that. It all starts next with The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
Saxophonist Isaiah Collier takes us on a powerful journey through the story of 400 years. A sweeping large ensemble suite that explores the sounds of Black history from the Middle Passage to the Great Migration and beyond.
Showcasing that is very important because history repeats itself.
That's next time on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride. Join me for Jazz Night in America, Sunday at 8, here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.